Committee on Loans, 342 on May 2nd. Present are President Cotton, President Fuller, and myself, President Dunn. The issues before us today, first issue I want to take up is House Bill 357. Mr. Gruenberg is here, maybe you could give us a brief explanation of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Max Gruenberg, representing District 11B in the House. I'm the author of House Bill 357, which simply allows daycare expenses to be utilized by recipients of state teacher loans and state student loans under both loan bills. It was not my intent to increase the amount of money for the loan program when I introduced this bill. I envisioned it as a vehicle to allow students to use their existing student loans for the purposes of child care. And if this is permitted, the student will receive a federal income tax credit and a state of, deduction, and a state of Alaska child care credit. The effect of this will be to entitle a student to some federal funds for the use of the child care, and in addition will not cost the state anything because I'm not seeking to put any more money in the program whatsoever. Also, it will lessen the demand on the state-subsidized child care program if the people can go to, for example, non-subsidized child care centers and just utilize their loans, which they will then pay back. And I've given you a copy of my comments here, and according to the Post-Secondary Commission, only a small percentage of people now who are students receive daycare assistance. And this is probably because a lot of them have their kids in unlicensed daycare, or they may be on the waiting list for daycare assistance. Maybe they can only afford to attend school part-time, or they have non-financial child care arrangements, family, friends, etc. Once again, this is simply to allow recipients to utilize the present amount of their loans for child care expenses. And to clarify this, I have prepared what I would request be considered as a committee substitute, clarifying that this is my intent. Use the long sheet, if you would, not the short sheet with the handwritten comments, because we didn't put the amendment into Section 2. And the language was suggested by Dr. Romsberg. Dr. Romsberg's exact language. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I really appreciate your scheduling the bill.
Thanks. Any questions? What I'd like to do, I think, Carrie, would you care to make a comment on regarding what the amendment does and how it relates to the fiscal note, and then adopt the amendment?
It's just one quick comment. I'm Carrie Romsberg, Director of the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. A quick comment. Under Section 2, we do need to add, in addition to the handwritten here, it should say at the end, however, the maximum loan award may not exceed the cost of books, tuition, required fees, room and board, and transportation, because transportation is an eligible expense only under the teacher scholarship loan program, so it should be added there. And then with that change, the difference in this is substantial. I misunderstood Representative Gruenberg's intention, and I give you a fiscal note that shows $9.6 million, and it would cost that much additional if this were added as a new expense that these students can use the money for. And we would either have to pump in an additional 9.6 or else use the current fund and turn away about 2,100 students. That would be the case if this were an additional expense. This language now says it's not. It simply gives the students the permission to use the existing loan they have for some other purposes. So it doesn't increase the cost of an individual's loan at all. And that's the intention of this new language.
Representative Fuller.
Then this fiscal note that we got from you should be zero.
It'll be zero now. The fiscal note for the committee substitute will be zero.
I don't understand how this can do anybody any good. If there's not going to be any more money, and the maximum loan award may not exceed the cost of books and so forth, that means they have to take their book money and use it for daycare expense. Is that right?
Well, their book money or their tuition money or their room and board money, that's correct.
Well, how can they do that? I mean, you wouldn't give them the loan if they didn't need it for those other purposes, right?
Unless needs defined an interesting way under the student loan program, as you may recall, Representative Cotton. If they said they needed it for that purposes and listed those as the expenses, that's what we would award them. That's correct.
Any other questions?
town get it. I mean, unless they're cheating, I think this bill doesn't do them any good.
Well, all I can tell you is Representative Grunberg would like the students to be able to use this, that existing money for childcare expenses. And I think for the reasons he pointed out, that it would give them some breaks in terms of the federal income tax and the state program. But in terms of giving them additional money.
Take the state loan money and turn it in for refundable credit from the state, that's it.
But it does. But you're absolutely correct. The net effect to the student is zero. They don't get a penny more by this this change.
I thought I just might be missing something. That's all I had. Mr. Chair, I'd move that the committee adopt the committee substitute that would include the amendments that are on the draft, the long draft.
Any objection? Hearing none, the amendments are adopted.
Move to pass the bill out of committee.
Motion to move the bill out of committee. Individual recommendations. Objection? Hearing none, the bill moves. Next item we have is Senate Bill 78, a proposed CS that's being handed out. But in the meantime, I'd like to get just an overview of what is in it. And we have Paul Arnold here from Department of Con. Paul, are you going to kind of lead us through the bill a little bit? And whomever else you want with you to help you out.
Thanks.
The intention of the chair on this bill, so everybody knows what's going on, is to go through the bill. We have to be on the floor at 4:30, so we have a short session today is to get through briefly through the bill. I have a proposed amendment to it that's in the CS, and I want to go through a little bit of that. We have some people here to testify on that matter, and then Representative Fuller, I may have mentioned on the floor, even moved the bill today. We're going to hold it for tomorrow to finish up the CS and then move the bill tomorrow. Go ahead, Paul.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Paul Arnold, Director of the Division of Investments. Senate Bill 78, the version by Finance, addresses several major areas, and I'd like to speak to the areas as opposed to going through the bill section by section, because there is a section analysis that has been prepared. One of the major things that the bill does is provide for the ability of the division to finance repossessed property. Currently, property that we have that is repossessed, we can only place for sale with cash offers, or the individual that is looking to purchase the property must otherwise qualify for the loan program. And what we're finding is that we're, as a result of this, in order to dispose of repossessed property, we're selling it far below market. And by providing the ability to finance this property, we feel that we could sell at close to market, and at the same time, it would be revenue generating for the state. The second area that that's addressed in the bill is loan assumptions of loans under the commercial fishing loan program. Based on the advice of the Attorney General, we currently cannot make loan assumptions unless the applicant meets the existing eligibility requirements of the loan program. If they have to meet the eligibility requirements of the loan program, it really isn't an assumption. We just make them a loan, and they turn around and pay off the previous loan. By allowing for loan assumptions, we feel that many of the commercial fishermen that are in dire straits, that are facing default and foreclosure, could get out from underneath their loans by allowing someone else who is able to assume that loan to go ahead and assume that loan. There are also other individuals that just are looking to get out from under the industry and cannot find a buyer that would qualify for our loan program. So through the assumption process, they could qualify. The third area that's being addressed is pre-qualification of a loan for a limited entry permit. This has received considerable discussion as the bill has proceeded through the Senate side. Just a quick summary of my testimony for Senate Finance, and that is that anything can be done we feel that we can do the pre-qualifications. There has been a compromise struck where we've raised the fee to pre-qualify from $100 to $200 for those applicants who wish to have their application pre-qualified. Our concern is simply one of the commitment that is being made and the restrictions that we'd have to place in that commitment so that we don't end up exposing the state to a liability as a result of our commitment. Should, for example, something happen or change regarding the applicant or the deal that's being put together between the applicant and the seller of the permit. But we feel that we can probably work those, now loosely termed those, administrative difficulties, but I'd rather have it under the category of protecting the state's interest. Those kind of difficulties out. One of the final categories is technical amendments. There's some language that's being cleaned up. There's a little bit of reorganization within the chapter that should help clarify some of the issues that have been addressed and clarified through AG's opinions that we're finally just putting in the statutes to codify the interpretations that have been given to us. The final two areas, foreclosure proceedings, is an area that's addressed in Maggie's division, as well as the revenue that would be generated by the bill. And I could turn it over to Maggie and let her speak to those two issues.
I'm Maggie Hamley, Director of the Division of Accounting and Collections. Did you want to have questions for Paul first? Or?
Why don't you just go through the bill there?
Right, the two areas in the bill that affect my division are the language for foreclosure expense accounts in the various loan programs that do not have that language. We currently have this language in the statute for the Commercial Fishing Loan Fund. Basically, what the foreclosure expense...
Very good. Let us follow along with you in the bill.
Sure.
Where you are.
We work off the Senate bill as it came across in the folder rather than the CS is in the page and line number.
In sections 12 through 19, 21 through 31 and 33, starting on page 8, section 12 establishes a foreclosure expense account for fisheries enhancement. Section 15 establishes a foreclosure expense account for the Veterans Loan Program.
Maybe you could just explain what a foreclosure expense account is, because I know you set one up for almost every loan program.
What the purpose of the foreclosure expense account is to provide a better audit trail for foreclosure expenses and to ensure that adequate cash reserves are available to fund essential expenditures encountered during foreclosure action. The current procedure is that the department does have the and exercises its authority under general powers and duties to protect the assets of the various loan funds. The funds are expended and subsequently recovered at the time of sale for the following types of expenditures: attorney fees and costs, appraisal evaluation expenses, litigation reports and title searches, repair expenses, maintenance expenses, caretaker, storage, moorage, or dry dock for the fleet of repossessed vessels that we have, publication notices, insurance, utilities, U.S. Marshal fees, cost to protect the security against superior liens where failure to do so would cause loss to the state, selling expenses, and other direct costs attributable to the defaulted loan. The history and characteristics of each loan program would be considered in determining the amount of cash reserve to be established the first year. After the first year, the history of the foreclosure expense account itself would be taken into consideration when setting the reserve for the following year. Some of the considerations in setting the reserves would include the foreclosure rates, the type of collateral, typical expenditures associated with foreclosures within each program, average loan balances, or in other words, the amount at risk, total outstanding balances within the loan program, and probability of prior or superior liens threatening our security. For example, on a vessel, there are labor liens or mechanics liens, or if the borrower didn't have adequate insurance for the crew could be suing and there could be liability that has been established against the vessel that would come before our security. The Commercial Fishing Revolving Loan Fund specifically allows for a foreclosure expense account, and this was established with a $250,000 reserve out of fund equity. And that amount is not available for lending unless we go in and reassess the amount that we need in the reserve. We estimate that the Mining Loan Fund may need a reserve of $300,000 to $500,000 established due to the larger average size of loan and also the fact that the default rate is running about 34%. Also, the increased cost to recover equipment pledged as security is a problem.
Well, what kind of money are going to be a reserve from fund equity? How's the fund going to be established originally?
Well, the fund is already established, and we're already using this money to do what we're required to do by statute to administer the fund, and it's basically just to establish a better audit trail. So when legislators have questions about what our foreclosure expenses have been, we have a better way to collect them all in one account and give you that information and have that information for ourselves so that we know what's necessary as far as the cash balance in the fund.
Okay, so these special accounts that are being established now, we've got by reserve fund equity, you're not looking for any appropriations
no.
to put in there?
No.
We're using just money out of the existing appropriations?
We're doing exactly
program.
What we're doing now, except we're creating a better audit trail.
Okay.
Do you feel you have the existing authority
yes.
to do this?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, and I have some details if you're interested in the reserves that we've established on the other loan funds. The other major change that the Division of Accounting and Collections has requested, and this was the original reason that the bill was drafted a year or two ago, is that the current statutes under AS 1610-300 for the Commercial Fishing Loan Fund are very specific on a default of a permit. There is no court hearing if a borrower defaults on a permit. We simply send out a letter that follows very specific language under the statute, and it starts a clock counting down the days. Under the current statute, the borrower has 15 days to request a hearing. If the borrower misses that 15-day period for any reason, let's say they didn't get the notice, or they were on vacation or something, then they can no longer request a hearing under the current statute. Under the statute, they have 60 days to bring the loan current from the date the notice is mailed, and then 120 days to pay it off. If they miss any one of those deadlines, there's no recourse, and the permit comes back to us. What we're asking for is allowing the commissioner the flexibility to establish good cause, or for the borrower to establish good cause and come to the commissioner and request a waiver of one of the time limits. We've had several lawsuits where it would have been administratively much better for the department and the state to have had the flexibility to look at good cause and waive the countdown of those days, and all we're asking for is to allow the commissioner to have that flexibility. And that's
what section is that in?
That's in the section numbers change every time the bill comes out. Let's see.
This is the final version of the Senate.
This is what came across from the Senate.
Yeah, I think it's in section 9 now. Yes, that's in section 9.
So you're changing that from certified to first class mail?
We're changing it from registered to, it was registered and certified, and registered is not appropriate, so we're changing it to certified or first class so that we send both to the borrower. And Department of Law has suggested some language about presuming that the borrower receives the notice, and that gives them the opportunity to rebut that presumption and to show that they didn't receive it, and that gives us the flexibility to deal with it. Another suggestion was to require proof of service, and that causes harm to the state in those cases where the borrower skips the state and we can't find him. There's no way for us to foreclose on the permit. So what we've tried to do is strike a balance that's a lot more fair to the borrower than the current statute is, and still gives the state the power to foreclose on permits as needed.
How do you foreclose on the permit if you can't find the
Well, the current statute the countdown starts from the postmark date of the notice.
But I mean, don't you physically have to get the permit back from it? You can just revoke it?
No, that goes through limited entry.
So you can revoke it at limited entry, and this guy can be walking around with this permit, but it's not official anymore.
I think they have to renew it. What happens if you do repossess the permit, then? Who sells it?
We do. We're required by the statute to
have it. Have you done any of those?
Mm-hmm.
What's the procedure that you use to sell it?
We advertise, first of all, in all the major newspapers and the local ones in the areas of the fishery and statewide.
And then what do you put them up to for an auction, or?
We offer them for sale. So the department reserves the right, because the borrower is responsible for any deficiency, we reserve the right to turn down all offers if they're not close to the limited entry value.
What do you do if you have 10 people after the same permit?
Well, we've never had a case where they've all come in at exactly the same dollar amount.
Well, they just place a bid then?
Mm-hmm. They
or
make
a sealed bid?
They make an offer. In legal terms, it's slightly different from a bid. We'd have to accept the highest bid if it were a bid sale. It's an offering.
So your policy is to take the highest offer?
If it's a reasonable offer. So far, we've foreclosed on 20 permits in the life of the loan program.
Have you ever had to sell one at a deficiency?
Oh, most of them are sold at a deficiency. For a while, the power control permits were going for $36,000, and many of the loans were made at that level, and then the market dropped, the bottom dropped out of the market, and we were selling them for $20,000. So it's not a good situation.
Okay. Is there anybody from CFAB here? I see much of the bill is to change some statutes around to give you a higher resale value on property. I think that's what the CFAB amendment is too. But it's kind of, some of it is affects kind of a policy change in the program, though. Page 3, line 8, and I think that's back to you, Paul. It basically states an applicant for a loan. This is on the assumption provision. Approval of an assumption would be consistent with the purpose of 300. And then it says an applicant for a loan assumption may not be disqualified because the applicant does not meet loan eligibility requirements under one of the subsections. You see any abuse problems in that?
No. As a matter of fact, that language is exactly what we proposed. What we're doing there is.
But I mean, in terms of, I know you probably proposed the language, but in terms of an applicant who qualifies under this program, which is a pretty small group of people, just going in and qualifying and then just passing his loan over to somebody else who really wanted the loan but couldn't qualify under the program.
I would suppose that's possible. I don't think we really anticipate that, because right now the original applicant is bound by the loan limitation, for example, $100,000, and with the assumption they're still out, could be out for that amount, so they forego their eligibility under the program while that loan is in existence. So
would the person assuming the loan also be bound by the $100,000 limit?
Yes. Because in essence, either one or both are liable. So really, if one or the other can't make it, the other one is subject to the total outstanding obligation. So that would affect their eligibility.
Okay, now, I haven't got through all the language. I'll just note on page 10, section 20, I think that's the CFAB statute. do you have the same type of provisions in your resale stuff? Basically, this says that even though the original loan, you had to be a resident of Alaska to get the original loan, that if CFAB forecloses on you, that this gives the board of directors of the ability to make the determination that if it's necessary in the loan to preserve the value of the property held by the bank as security, that they can make a loan to somebody regardless of residency.
In all cases, under the FISH program, but in all cases, we require the minimum 2-year residency, whether it's either a loan, an assumption of a loan, or for pre-qualification.
Yeah, I just note for the record, I think the one of the items that I've been made aware of, like under CPAP, they foreclosed on a plant and had to go resell it because they only could sell it for cash for Alaska. They'd take a real beating on the deal and lost budget value on it.
The only thing I would like to point out is that under property disposal, we do not require that they be a resident of the state. However, we do require that it is indeed in the best interest of the state for us to allow that disposal.
For you to make this disposal.
Yeah. As long as it's in the best interest of the state, then we can do that. And I think what the Senate was thinking there is they wanted to allow us as much flexibility to get rid of this property rather than being a warehouse of repossessed property.
Plus, we're currently getting less than 25 cents on the dollar now on cash sales on vessels. And we feel like if we can amortize the payments on repossessed collateral, that we'll get a much better return to the loan fund. And we have no requirement that the individual receiving the financing on the collateral be a resident of the state.
The other part I think that's inherent in there is that what we don't want to do is to bury the original borrower through deficiency when, if we had some latitude, we could unload that property at a higher price and then not have to go against the original borrower for any deficiency. So what we're trying to do is, in essence, not only protect the state's best interest, but really the interests of the borrowers who we've really got on the line, because what we sell at is going to dictate how much we can continue to go after any existing collateral we have.
Are all of the loans you make all recourse loans and all deficiency type loans?
Yes.
You don't make any non-recourse?
That's correct.
Okay. Anybody have any more questions?
The other thing that I wanted to bring up is on our fiscal notes there, this is a revenue generating bill. And we've prepared a fiscal note for Division of Accounting and Collections, and there's also one for Division of Investments. Our fiscal note indicates that we estimate about $175,000 will be returned to the loan fund the first year this bill is in effect, increasing by the end of the fifth year to over $500,000. This is as a result of application fees for assumptions, assumption fees, pre-qualification fees, and then the recovery on losses on loans that we presently have because of being forced to take cash 25 cents on the dollar, basically, on repossessed property. And it's basically...
Let me follow that up. That's because you're going to be able to finance the sale?
We'll be able to take payments over time, amortize the sale, so we'll get closer to a market value. My fiscal note, both Division of Investments and Division of Accounting and Collections fiscal note have some minimal operating expenses that will be funded by the receipts coming into the loan fund from the revenue generation of the bill. And Senate Finance Committee agreed to fund these out of the Commercial Fishing Revolving Loan Fund, offset by the revenues that were coming into the fund. I've requested about $10,000 for overtime associated with the assumption activity that's going on. And Division of Investments has requested $197,000.8 for the additional positions required as a result of the assumption, allowing assumptions and the pre-qualifications.
Okay, appreciate it.
The other comment I can make on the bill is that this, a very similar bill to this, has passed the Senate in the previous year and the House through two House rules, actually to the floor, and then pulled back to House rules. And that bill was then ultimately died in House rules, primarily because of the provision allowing for, or an amendment that was hung on to it, allowing for some loans to be made for subsistence fishermen who fished off the Yukon and Kuskokwim drainage area, and that really killed the bill at that point. But the rest of the provisions have gone really through the legislation now 3 years running, so.
We won't try to hang too much on the bill if I want to translate that.
Thank you very much.
Friendly crowd here.
Minor.
We have a couple of minor amendments.
This other one was a minor amendment, too.
One I'd like you to look at, Paul, if you have the CS there, or the proposed CS. We had a bill that came through earlier differentiating between historical districts and historical properties. I think it, I don't remember the bill number on it. You remember that one, 283, but...
Remember the bill, Millet's bill, and just everybody agreed to it.
Everybody agreed to it here, that what we've done is in a historical loan program, that your building has to be in a historical district before you can get a historical loan. So you'll note on page 10, section 18, we've gone and amended the duties of the committee there to change the word district to property. This may be over in DNR, I'm not sure. But the intent is that if you have a historical property out in, on a roadway somewhere, and you don't, or basically to take Anchorage, for example, there is no historical district in Anchorage, yet there are historical buildings in Anchorage. This was to kind of make the program available to it. And I took the liberty to propose it as a CS into this bill here, since you were amending the historical loan program anyway. But I'd appreciate it if you'd look that over and comment on that by tomorrow, see if that's going to cause any additional fiscal problems. Not really getting into the fact of whether it generates more loans or not.
I think, the only thing, Mr. Chairman, if I recall, there was considerable demand out there, but we didn't, the funding in the loan program was basically gone, so.
Yeah, I'd just like to look at it from the administrative side, whether it affects your administrative fiscal note or not. Obviously, if you don't have the money in the loan program, you can't make the loan. The other issue doesn't affect your department. We have some people here to testify to the committee, and basically if the committee would look at the proposed CS, the long sheet on page 14. What I propose is a forest products business loan guarantee program. I can't really say I propose it. And we have some people from the industry here I'd like to have testify at this time. For the committee, we have about 15 minutes. And Paul, if you could come back with us tomorrow, maybe you can comment on that. I appreciate it. Thanks. Yeah, we're going to try to do this 3:30. But I'd like to start. John Sturgeon, do you have some comments you can give us on this to lead off with? Or do you have, Jim, you want to start? Why don't you?
Mr. Chairman, why don't I just, my name is Jim Clark. Representing the Alaska Loggers Association. With me here today, let me just introduce him here just to save time, Jim Reinerson from Alaska Pulp Corporation, Mr. Bob Losher from Sea Alaska Corporation, Mr. Steve Seeley from Wrangell Forest Products Corporation. They can answer any problems, concerns you might have about how the banking industry works in conjunction with the timber industry. Mr. Chairman, we are in support of what are sections 30 through 34 of the committee substitute, which establishes the, which actually amends the Forest Products Business Loan Guarantee Program. Last year, you passed what amounted to a loan guarantee program for an employee stock ownership plan, essentially for the employees of Ketchikan Pulp Company to purchase that facility. That what amounted to a segregation of money within the rainy day account for that guarantee program. That is going to lapse, I think, as of June 30th of this year. The employees have voted not to go forward with that program. And so what we have attempted to do, and what is proposed by these amendments, which we support, is to turn that program, make it available as a guarantee program to the industry at large. What we're proposing here is not a subsidized loan program. It's not a under-collateralized program. What we're trying to get at is a very reasonable, responsible, commercially reasonable program that would have the following attributes. Basically, it would have to be an 80%, we're talking about an 80% guarantee program, 20% by the banking industry. The banking industry would have to administer this program and would have a stake in the outcome of these loans, so we feel that they'd have a lot of incentive to make certain that the program was carried out and that there was full collateral and that it was a commercially reasonable venture. If the Department of Revenue felt that that wasn't the case, then it wouldn't allow the program to be used for that purpose. There are certain requirements that basically this be an Alaska business that receive the benefits. There is a 1% user fee attached to the program for the purpose of the state taking the risk. We feel that there is relatively small amount of risk to the state in this program because it's primarily aimed at helping the sawmills throughout the state enhance their facilities. Basically, there's about 110 million board foot market for timber products in South Central and the interior. The industry presently gets about 5 to 10% of that market. We believe we can increase it dramatically if we are able to purchase the planers, the kiln dryers, and creosote or pressure plants for these mills. That would allow us to make an enhanced product both for export and for use in the state. So we feel that these are commercially reasonable, commercially responsible enterprises, been around for a long time, that would take advantage of this program to upgrade their facilities and be able to go into these enhanced markets. That's a very short, capsulized version, Mr. Chairman. I have some testimony that I can hand into you that is a little bit provides a little bit more detail, but I know you're very short on time.
Jim, you chaired the governor's timber task force. Is this part of the task force report?
The task force did not recommend loan programs as part of its task force report. This is something that the task force has discussed, and quite frankly, given the revenue picture in the state this year, we've tried to work by consensus inside the task force, and we did not want to put anybody from the administration on the spot with respect to any kind of loan program this year. So we never brought it. We brought it up and discussed it within the task force. The industry fully supports it, and we've got support for this from people from Delta to the Kuskokwim River to Kodiak to Matanuska Valley at the southeast. We've got support across the state for this program, but we did not pass it out, or it did not attempt to pass it through the task force.
A couple things real quick. Where is the repealer of the other section?
That is a, that would be part of the reappropriation.
What the intention there, it would, with the committee is to send a letter to the Finance Committee to recommend that they put it in House Bill 195, which I believe is coming up from the Finance Committee on Tuesday.
But this language wasn't scheduled to sunset, though, is that correct?
No, this language here, if you'll note, like on page 14, line 15, you'll see the language is being deleted. This is an existing program that was there, but the appropriation of the $25 million or the segregation of the rainy day account was that if it was not utilized by June 30th, 1985, the portion that was not utilized would lapse back to the rainy day account. I don't have it in front of me, but
that's precisely correct.
Okay, the other question I have is on section 32 there on page 15, that you came with an 80% state guarantee versus 20% bank, as opposed to 50% current law. What was the rationale?
The rationale for that, Representative Cotton, was that 80% was what it would take to make to get a fine line between what the banks would be willing to do and what would also mean that the banks would have a stake in the outcome of the loan.
I understand that part of us having a stake in it, but the 20% versus 50% is the people that you talk to in the banking industry felt like they would 50%. Only be willing to risk 20%.
Right. The 50% is not viewed as something that the banks would go with. Maybe Steve Seeley could speak to that for just a moment, because we have checked with the banks on this very point in order to answer questions other people have about the program.
The biggest thing that I found...
Hey, just for the record, you got to identify who you are for the paper.
Okay, I'm Steve Seeley, Franklin Forest Products. I spoke with our bank, National Bank of Alaska, this morning concerning this. The biggest thing that this guarantee program will do for the banks and the timber industry is upgrade their portfolio. Currently in our operation, we run right up to their maximum lending limits, just in our working capital line with our pre-roading that we have to do to go into the forest, which forces them in the outside market to get joint participation from, say, U.S. Bank of Oregon or somewhere else. But the state guarantee, it gives it a better rating and makes it easier for them to put out, or just their portfolio is a lot better for the Fed, so they observe and take a look at it.
Yeah, I think my, just from the chairman's point, is the interest rate is whatever interest rate you can negotiate with the bank. The state's not an interest substitute.
That's right.
Here, so to make an effective difference with the guarantee program, you really needs to get about 70 or 80% before it makes any effective difference if you're in your bank. And that's kind of been my experience, and that's why we picked the 80% number there.
Mr. Chairman, that's the information we did get from the banking community on that.
It's 50% current law. I know it's current law. It's just something you're amending to fix, to meet your situation. Now, the previous program felt they could make it 50%.
Yeah.
Well, it was the rest of the language, though, is the 50% you have to read through was up to $30 million, and it was a little different program in terms of what it was guaranteeing and what was being made available for. I believe, I know Milt, you were involved in that last year, I believe, maybe.
Well, you're going to hold this over till tomorrow, anyway, so there's time to take a look at revenue or tax revenue.
Well, Milt, you're available tomorrow with us, or?
I won't be, Tom, the candidate manager of the division will be.
Okay, I'd appreciate it if you guys would look at this program and maybe see what you do about a fiscal note in terms of the administration of it, because this isn't the revenue department. We do need a administrative fiscal note.
Is the department going to take a position on this program?
Chairman, no, we don't have a position on the matter.
Yeah, we have a neutral position from the governor's office on this program, I believe. We have John Sturgeon. Are you with us tomorrow, John, or are you going to just...
I can be with him today.
Be at 3:30 here. Okay, I appreciate it. The reason I wanted John to comment is what effect he may think this has on the interior businesses and stuff. I know we've got quite a bit of testimony from them. But the intention would be, unless the committee reads through the bill with this great title and has any other recommendations, we're going to move this bill tomorrow along with a letter to the Chairman of the Finance Committee regarding the funding and House Bill 195. But with that, we're adjourned. We have to go to the floor.
Howdy, how are you?